Today on Off Mic, Northwest Indiana is home to a new vaccination center. We'll visit with Indiana Governor Eric Holcomb and State Health Commissioner Dr. Christina Box to tell us the significance of the opening of this new center in Gary. And while Governor Holcomb's mask mandate is now over, some of you tell me why you plan to keep wearing your mask. And one town in Northwest Indiana is proposing making getting a vaccine mandatory for all employees. And April is National Donate Life Month. We'll learn about how and why you should become an organ donor. All this on Off Mic. Welcome to Off Mic on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Michael Puente, reporter with WBEZ in Chicago. The site of the now-closed Roosevelt High School in Gary is the new site for a new mass vaccination center. It will be operated by FEMA and the Indiana State Health Department. Indiana Governor Eric Holcomb and Indiana State Health Commissioner were on hand for the opening earlier this week, as were several other dignitaries like U.S. Congressman Frank J. Marvan and Indiana State Rep. Earl Harris Jr. Let's start off with Congressman Marvan.
This is what I envisioned. I envisioned our nation, our state, local, and federal, and city agencies coming together to make a difference so that we get through a pandemic and we help get to the other side so we can have a safe quality of life. This is where the rubber meets the road. When I voted yes, I envisioned making sure we used every resource possible to overcome this pandemic here in Northwest Indiana. And so today is a day of celebration of a collaborative effort that we came together in unity to be able to provide for Northwest Indiana residents a safe vaccine that can help us get back to normal and can allow us to get back to where we need to be to celebrate with our families and to share in the joy of being healthy. So ultimately, today is also a call to action. Today is a call to action to know that vaccine acceptance is something that can change our lives and put us on the path to recovery. So together today, we are ambassadors to go out into the world and to share with our neighbors and friends that this vaccine makes a difference for our quality of life and most importantly, our health and economic recovery to what we have put forward. And lastly, I have gone through a lot of churches through Northwest Indiana, and there is one saying that rings true from every religious group. I am my brother's and sister's keeper. Let us go out, get vaccinated, and hold that to be true, that we have a responsibility to be our brother's and sister's keeper to spread health. I thank all of you, and as a member of Congress, it is my privilege to introduce a friend of mine, and I also want to do something because I just saw her. Dr. Box has also worked tirelessly. She was also, give her a round of applause. We were at Calumet High School 2 weeks ago where she rolled up her sleeves along with the National Guard, along with the healthcare providers, making sure people in our communities and our vulnerable populations are vaccinated. That being said, I commend you, Dr. Box, for your tireless commitment, dedication to our health. With that, I'd like to introduce a friend and a friend of Gary, Senator Eddie Melton.
Thank you, Congressman. Good afternoon. Well, first, I want to reiterate my thanks and gratitude to Administrator Kevin Sly, to the governor, to the congressman, and every single elected official and community leader in the room today. Throughout the state of Indiana and across the entire nation, we've all experienced trying times over the past year. COVID-19 has exposed the strengths and the very weaknesses of every level of our government, and it has truly tested our society and even our individual lives. But we have shown that we are most resilient in our community, in our state, and throughout the nation. From small businesses struggling to adapt to the new normal, to our teachers trying to educate our children virtually, and our individual families standing in long lines at the food banks and food pantries across the nation. It's been a fight, and it's been a tenacious fight, but the people are resilient. It's been a fight with COVID-19, COVID-19 didn't hold us back. This is why I want to commend the swift response of our local leaders, from our mayor, but especially to our council, and especially to our governor. Now, the governor and I have a good, we're good friends. We may have a different abbreviation behind our names, one being a D, one being an R. But I can say this, the governor has been a true fighter for the people of Indiana. I stand by the decisions he's made to protect this city, protect the state, and I believe he's done a fine job. So let's thank the governor for his work. Regardless of political affiliations or differences of opinion, he's done a phenomenal job. So I want to publicly thank him and Dr. Box as well. And the entire administration, I will say this, they've come before the General Assembly to testify on legislation and to see the quick and swift response in real time, to have the ability to address critical issues in real time is paramount for administration to do. And we should not take that ability from them. Whether it's increased need for COVID-19 testing sites, the governor picked up the phone, he arrived, he was there. Representative Harris and myself and the Black Caucus, we met with the governor, we expressed our concerns about our communities of color. We met with him and Dr. Box, and they responded immediately. So thank you for your quick response. And I want to thank my friend Congressman Mervan in terms of his vote for the American Rescue Plan. These dollars are not just dollars that we can see coming to our community, but these will be transformational dollars to not only address the fight for COVID-19, but to transform our communities for generations to come. And I want to thank the Biden and Harris administration for taking this pandemic on within their first 100 days. 100 million people within their first 100 days was the goal, and I believe they exceeded that. So today launches the mass vaccination site. There's an example of effective collaboration among all levels of government. The city is blessed to have a phenomenal health commissioner in Dr. Roland Walker. And I want to personally thank him in his absence for all of his hard work and his leadership, even as he and his family struggle with COVID-19. So now it's time, just like it was mentioned before, like every other speaker, us as leaders, us as community advocates, for us to do our part. Just like Deputy Mayor, I received my shot. I'm fully vaccinated. My family is becoming fully vaccinated. But it's incumbent upon us as community leaders to express the importance, the safety precautions, and not assuming that it's okay to get comfortable and get relaxed in terms of not social distancing and not wearing our mask. So all of the leaders has been very strong in doing so. I want to encourage you all to do so. For the time coming. So I'm extremely honored to be here with a tremendous group of folks and individuals, and now I want to bring forth a good friend of mine and a leader in the city of Gary, Representative Earl Harris Jr.
Hello, everybody. Thank you for the opportunity to be in front of you. I want to begin first by giving thanks. So one of the things that happened last year, we know that Northwest Indiana was getting hit hard. It was one of the hottest places in terms of people getting COVID. And I wrote a letter to the governor and asked, can you please, we're being hit hard, can you put additional free testing in the cities of Gary, East Chicago, and Hammond? And I want to thank the governor, because he and Dr. Box, who's trying to hide back there, but we see her, and the State Department of Health stepped up and provided free testing in the area to make sure that our people were protected, showed the value and the belief in Northwest Indiana. So I want to publicly thank both of you for that and show you my great appreciation. And then going with that, I want to say thank you for the opportunity for this to happen, that we're here in Gary, we're here at Roosevelt. It's a great opportunity for people to get testing, putting testing here, as the governor said, eliminating every way possible that might prevent someone from getting the test to get the test. So please encourage, let people know. The other thing that's important that's been pointed out, and Senator Melton mentioned this, is the collaboration. You know, one of the things we have to look at and think about is, when you talk about COVID, it's not an R, it's not a D, it's a we. And how do we collaborate, no matter which side of the aisle you're on, no matter which letter is after your name, how do we work together to protect and take care of people? So in closing, I want to say to you, I've had my vaccination. I tell people, if you haven't gotten your shot, here's a great opportunity, even today, to get your shot. There'll be 8 weeks of opportunity after this. Please let everyone know the vital importance of this, the life-saving, what this means to your families, what this means to your friends, what this means to your loved ones. Please, please, please get the word out, get vaccinated. Grab your family and friends, throw them in the car, tell them you're taking them to dinner, and stop by here and get them vaccinated. Do whatever you can to make that happen.
And now Indiana Governor Eric Holcomb and Indiana State Health Commissioner Dr. Christina Boggs taking questions from the media following the formal presentation.
Yeah, we look at a number of indicators and factors and numbers. Obviously, positivity rate is an outcome of various other indicators. And I want to make sure, first and foremost, that our capacity to care for those who are in need have it. And so we look at, yes, positivity, we look at hospitalization rates, we look at death rates, and we look at what is our inventory, our fresh availability of PPE, for an example, ICU beds, doctors, assistants, nurses, and we have the ability right now to care for those who are in that need. I'm still couldn't be more clear about the need to play this through to the very end. Make sure, as was said inside under the tent, to practice physical distancing, 6 feet. Outdoors is better than indoors. Wear a mask when you're around others. I'm going to continue to do that. And so there is some personal responsibility, as well as the policy recommendations and guidelines that we and the CDC put out.
But you can see how this can be confusing to some, because we are experiencing a high positivity rate. We are seeing these other variants pop up. It's not like we're over the hump.
Yeah. We're not through at all. The light gets brighter and brighter. We have more capacity to care. With the vaccination online as well, folks have the ability to get vaccinated. And that's what we always wanted to make sure, is that folks had the ability not just to practice their own vigilance, but to also be vaccinated. And that's online right now. That's why days like today are so important. It gets us that much closer. And right here in Gary, Indiana, we're turning that light brighter and brighter every single day. We have the ability to do 100,000 people. That doesn't mean you can throw caution to the wind, but you're right, the positivity rate, I look at the slope, I look at the whether it's plateaued, I look at where it's at. It's under 5 as we sit today on a 7-day average. Imagine where we used to be when our capacity to care for those who were in need was threatened.
But if you're doing so well, why lift it at all? Why lift it right now?
Well, that's an endless question you could ask. We have the ability to care for those who are in need, and we have the ability to vaccinate those who want to be. Some may never get vaccinated. And that's on them, too.
Governor, is there any concern? I know you made the announcement that anybody from even out of state can get the vaccine in Indiana. Any concerns that maybe there won't be enough for Hoosiers?
Well, you want to address the inventory, but we have enough for Hoosiers.
We do, and I think the important thing right now is we want to make sure there are no barriers to anyone getting vaccinated. If you are eligible, if you are 16 and older, you can get the Pfizer vaccine, and we want to make sure that residency and, you know, whether you are here documented or undocumented, whether you have a disability, whether, you know, whatever your age is, we want to make sure that there is no barrier to your getting that vaccine. That's where we are right now, and the federal government has said that we will have enough vaccine in the coming weeks to be able to do this, and we trust them in that.
Dr. Boggs, you know, several counties, Marion County, St. Joseph County, Elkhart, LaPorte County, have all kept their mask mandates in place despite the state. Are they looking at different medical factors than you, or have you discussed that decision with them? I mean, why would they keep it, but the state?
Right. I think, again, every local government, local public health, can work with their elected officials and decide if they want to keep the mask mandate longer. Oftentimes, it is our more urbanized, larger populations that choose to do that, and they tend to have more issues with the spread of cases, like in downtown Marion County, in downtown downtown St. Joe in South Bend area. So I can understand them doing that. The important thing to remember here is that the science hasn't changed. Whether it's a mask mandate or a mask advisory, we ask you to put your masks on until more people are vaccinated so that we know that there is less disease out there. And these mitigation measures work against the variants just as they work against the original wild strain of the virus that we had. Certainly, we will expect the numbers that may go up after spring break, after the NCAA, after we've had Easter and we've all been together. And again, we've asked people to continue those same mitigation measures to protect themselves. And we will be watching that closely. We are seeing our increased cases in our younger population. And that's why we're really trying to get the message out that we want those 20-year-olds and 30-year-olds and 16-year-olds to get out and get vaccinated. They want their lives back. So a lot of them are really rushing to get this done.
Governor Eric Holcomb was asked about his decision to lift the mask mandate, and was it pushed by any political pressures?
Nothing could be further from the truth. If this is a fault, I'm in a bubble that devours data. And that's how we make our decisions. I am liberated from any political motivation. Period.
And while Governor Eric Holcomb's mask mandate is no longer, some of you plan to keep wearing your mask.
Hello, my name is Evelyn Botondo and I live in Griffith. I plan to continue wearing my mask because I trust no one and this disease is very nasty. First part, I trust no one. You don't know where people have been, who they've been around, or when they've gotten tested, if ever. I don't want to get this disease, so I will continue to wear my mask.
Hey, Michael, this is Lizbeth Mendez from Chicago, Illinois. I received both of the vaccines. Most people around me have as well. I will continue to use a mask when I have to, but when given a choice, I will not. That should not impact my decision making in going somewhere shopping or dining out in Indiana.
Hello, my name is Kelly. I'm from Crown Point. I will be continuing to wear my mask past the end date of the mask mandate because it's the right thing to do. I'm fully inoculated and have traveled to other states where the mask mandate has ended. However, I'd like to point out that most, if not all, the businesses were still requiring masks while you were in their facility.
This is Stacy Kellogg. I'm a resident of Lafayette, Indiana. And yes, I will continue to wear masks because I believe it's important to follow the guidance of trusted scientific experts who are advocating that masks help prevent the spread of the virus.
Hi, my name is Ed Maldonado from East Chicago, Indiana. I'm going to keep wearing my mask even though I know the mandate is over. I think basically it's because I'm not certain that we're 100% cured or 100% good to not wear a mask. I know people say masks may not do much, or I think it does. I think all the experts say it does. It just makes sense to continue to wear the mask for a little bit longer. And also, I've been vaccinated, and I still think it's important to wear the mask, not only for my protection, but also to kind of show others that maybe you should be wearing your mask too, even though because I'm vaccinated, I probably isn't much need for me to wear it.
My name is Brandon Tamayo. I am from Hammond, Indiana, and I still plan on wearing my mask after tomorrow. Because even though I have been fully vaccinated since February, I could be an asymptomatic spreader and not know it and spread it to other people who are still waiting for the vaccine and those who have immune compromises. And even though with the vaccine rollout, I'm still going to wear my mask because there are still limited doses for people who are still waiting to get their shots.
Kelly DePiro, Crown Point. I will absolutely be wearing my mask everywhere I go. And I am vaccinated, and I am upset that he's dropping the mask mandate.
And the town of Merrillville is also thinking about requiring vaccinations for all town employees. I got a chance to speak with Merrillville Town Council President Rick Bella about that proposal.
Well, the idea is, and what our position has been from the very start, Mike, is that we want to continue keeping the public safe. And our town employees, many of them come in contact with, you know, residents, many on a daily basis. And we just want to make sure that, you know, the town is not responsible for spreading the COVID-19 virus. And then we found out that as an employer, we can certainly require that. And so it's something we're really just considering. There's nothing definite yet. We're just kind of seeing what's possible and what we should do or shouldn't do. Or the first step, and we're doing it right now, is conducting a survey of how many town employees of our 150 employees have already received the vaccination. So, you know, it may not be a big issue once we get the final numbers back, because we feel that most of our police officers have, and the firefighters, of course. And so when you look at it as a whole, it may just be a couple handfuls of people that just haven't gotten it to yet. And so we can certainly ask them if they plan to. So that's our first step. But we did put together some documents to review as far as a mandatory vaccination policy. And, of course, like any policy, there's always areas where you don't have to comply. And one of them is a religious accommodation. If someone for a religious reason doesn't want to get a vaccination, they can fill out a simple form. We put them in their file, and they, of course, wouldn't have to do that. Also, of course, there's a medical exemption form. And so for some reason they don't, their doctor says they shouldn't be vaccinated, we would simply just place that in their employee file too, and they would not be required to do the vaccination.
All right. And you've already did the research on that. The town can legally require employees to get the COVID vaccine.
Yes. In that process too, I believe, I can't say this for sure, I think that almost any employer can require that if it comes to a point where you need to keep employees and members of the public safe. You can actually require it. Doesn't mean that you should per se, but you know, it's a touchy subject, just like COVID has been for over a year. And so we want to make sure we're not offending people, of course, but yet there's the safety concern. You know, we still are requiring masks and face coverings to be worn inside any town building, and all of our employees are going to be wearing their masks. So that's just one step that we felt, you know, we should do, even though the state relaxed that. You know, we thought that we're not quite ready to do that yet. Until our numbers are, you know, so much better, you know, we'll feel more comfortable then to just remove that mandate also. And that's just for town employees. It has nothing to do with, you know, anybody else in the town as far as businesses or anyone like that that can make up their own decision on those things.
And when will the town council be discussing this further?
We're going to discuss it more Tuesday night at our council meeting on the 13th. There won't be any votes or anything. It's just going to be a discussion. I want to make sure that we keep the ball rolling so that we come to at least a decision that you're going to do it or we're not going to do it, and then move forward.
And that was Maryville Town Council President Rick Bella. And we'll be back with more Off Mic. Welcome back to Off Mic on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Michael Puente. April is National Donate Life Month, a time designated to honor organ and tissue donors and celebrate the lives saved through the gift of donation. Before we get to my first guest, I want to share a story I did about a young undocumented woman from Northwest Indiana who was in desperate need of an organ transplant. This is from 2015.
Too little and stupid.
23-year-old Maria sits at her kitchen table as her young daughter reads to her.
Jill likes to walk. Jill.
We're not using Maria's last name because she and her husband entered the country illegally 8 years ago. Maria doesn't understand English, but just being able to sit up and listen is a feat in and of itself, and she can do other things now.
Now I'm able to walk, I'm able to exercise, I can eat anything I want, I can do everything.
Just a couple of months ago, all the mundane and routine activity that most of us take for granted, like washing dishes, was impossible for her to do. That's because Maria was sick, very sick. Maria says she always felt weak, even as a young girl in her native Michoacan, Mexico. 2 years ago, Maria found out her kidneys weren't working and she needed emergency dialysis.
I was living because of the dialysis. 3 days a week for 3 hours. I came out feeling very tired and dizzy. I just didn't feel well.
sentía bien.
Eventually, she was told by doctors she needed a new kidney. Under normal circumstances, getting an organ transplant is a dicey proposition, but Maria's immigration status made it even more difficult.
I tried to look for a donor and put my name on a waiting list, but they couldn't because I'm undocumented.
She just told me. She says, I'm going to die.
That's Jose Bustos. He runs Casa Santo Toribio, a center that provides services for those who are undocumented. It's part of St. Mary's Catholic Church, a parish of some 3,000 mostly Mexican families just over the state line in East Chicago, Indiana.
When you hear a 21, 22-year-old young lady tell you that she's going to die and she's afraid that she's not going to be able to see her family, it's heartbreaking.
Bustos started searching for a donor within the congregation who might be a biological match. He came up empty. Maria, though, didn't give up hope.
I have faith in God and the Virgin Mary, and I would always ask to give me another opportunity.
That's when St. Mary's pastor, Father Stephen Gibson, got involved.
I knew nothing about it. We just wanted to help her, and so I and others investigated what was their blood type and things like that. And I decided to do it just out of curiosity.
Father Gibson has been the pastor at St. Mary's for 20 years. The Oak Park native comes from a large Irish Catholic family, so Jose Bustos didn't think Gibson could help.
I said, Father, I'm Mexican. We didn't match. What makes you think, being a Caucasian person, that you're going to match?
But as they say, the Lord works in mysterious ways. Father Gibson got word from a doctor.
And he sent me a message saying, this is from God. You're 100% compatible.
I was in dialysis when I got the news. I was crying over the news that I got a donor and that I have someone for the kidney.
I wanted to do it, so when I found out I could, then there was no question. Not for the slightest moment.
The transplant was performed in April at Northwestern Memorial Hospital in Chicago by Dr. Juan Caicedo. He says ethnicity does not determine who can donate and receive organs.
Everyone beneath our skin, we're the same. You can be African-American, Asian, Hispanic, or Caucasian. All of us, we're kind of similar under our skin.
Caicedo, who heads Northwestern's Hispanic transplant program, says finding a willing donor is the toughest challenge.
The decision to help somebody else, you know, this doesn't happen every day. He's a priest. Then is a huge act of love.
But others aren't so lucky. About 100,000 people in the U.S. need an organ transplant every year, but fewer than 1 in 5 actually get one. In Illinois alone, 300 people die every year waiting for an organ. Kevin Seamunt leads Gift of Hope, a nonprofit network that secures organs in Illinois and Northwest Indiana. He says the 500,000 undocumented immigrants living in the Chicago area actually helps increase the odds.
We all benefit when our entire community participates in donation. So it's not that a non-citizen receiving an organ is taking one away from anyone. I see it as a larger pool of organs that frankly gives more people a chance to get transplanted.
Even if you find a donor, there's still the issue of how to pay for the operation. For Maria, she was able to obtain private insurance coverage through the efforts of Northwestern. Today, as she recovers from the procedure, she says she still lives in fear of being deported. But her new kidney has changed everything.
The day after the transplant, you feel like life has returned to you. You have a new life.
Back at the church in East Chicago, parishioners like Jose Bustos call what happened an act of God.
Un milagro in Indiana, the miracle in Indiana. And this miracle in Indiana gave a new lease to the life of this young lady.
Joining me now is the new president and CEO of Gift of Hope, Dr. Harry Wilkins, who joins us to talk more about National Donate Life Month. Hello, Dr. Wilkins. How are you?
I am doing well today. How are you?
Very good, very good. Dr. Wilkins, why don't you tell me a little bit about National Donate Life Month?
Sure. So it correlates with spring, and we always think about organ donation as, you know, new beginnings and that sort of things. In other words, you know, when organ donation happens, you know, a tragic event has occurred. Someone has lost their life. And one of the things that donation provides is a better ending, so to speak, for someone's life. You know, when someone dies and they're able to donate their organs or tissues, someone else is getting a new lease on life, and that brings a lot of comfort and healing to family. And in spring, you know, with the new renewal and everything else, I think that's why it's appropriate for Donate Life Month to occur every April. So that's what we're celebrating this April, is National Donate Life Month.
And I see that there are currently 108,000 people in the United States waiting for a life-saving organ transplant. What type of people are you looking for? Who is a good candidate to donate an organ?
Well, medical science has actually continued to increase. And it used to be that, you know, someone had to be in their 40s or 50s, and that's where we would cut off. These days, you know, it's not unheard of to have someone well into their 80s donate kidneys or a liver. You know, hearts and lungs, not quite so much. But more and more, what we want to do is we want to have anyone who has died in a hospital or a setting that may allow for the possibility of organ donation to call the OPO. That's what Gift of Hope is the organ procurement organization. And it's our job to evaluate for medical appropriateness, to approach families, to educate the community and hospital partners about the donation process, and then, of course, facilitate that process. So actually, the ability to donate is actually expanding as people are living longer, they're living healthier lives. So we can see people quite up in age that can actually donate.
Let me ask you this. When a person decides to be a organ donor, usually I guess you have to fill out the back of your driver's license, and I'm not sure how the process still is. But when that time comes when something tragic has happened, how do you approach a family to say, so your loved one was an organ donor and it's time to sort of harvest those organs?
Well, so there's quite a bit to unpack in that question, and I'd like to start with the process of becoming a registered organ donor. So I think most people understand that when you go to get your license, they ask you if you want to be an organ donor, and that is just one of many ways that you can register to be an organ donor. You actually don't even have to have a driver's license to be on what we call the donor registry, and the registry is just a list of people who have indicated their decision to become an organ donor upon their death. We have lots of people have organ donor drives, particularly in Donate Life Month. We put on donor registration drives. There are ways to go to the website. You can go to giftsofhope.org, and there's a link to sign up there. We also have it so that you can text HOPE, H-O-P-E, to 51555 on your cell phone, and that will send a link to be able to sign up. If you have an Apple iPhone, you can go to the Health app, and you can sign up to be registered donor there. So there's lots of different ways to register to be an organ donor other than just on your driver's license. The second thing I wanted to bring up is that once you have decided as an adult to become an organ donor and you register, it's what's called a first person authorization, upon your death, your wishes must be followed, and that's a legally binding document. It falls under gift law, so it's no different than if you were to write a will and you had a muscle car that you wanted to leave to your nephew. Upon your death, that will is binding under gift law that muscle car goes to your nephew. Same with organ donation, it's under gift law. The other part that we also say is that if you've made that decision to become an organ donor, the other critical piece is discuss it with your family and let them know that what your wishes are, because that comes down to the other part of when someone has died and they've had this tragic death, and then we have to, as an organ procurement organization, approach that family to get authorization to recover those organs. It has to be done very carefully. If you can imagine, these people are suffering the worst time of their life. And our organ coordinators are very skilled at number one, making sure that the needs of the family are met. We want to make sure that they've slept, that they've had something to eat, that they've had time to absorb the news before we then talk with them about the options or let them know that their loved one is actually in the registry. Because unfortunately, oftentimes the families don't know that their loved one has signed up. So I know that's a long, long answer, but there's quite a bit packed into that one question. There's lots along that line.
You know, so many people may not even, think about being an organ donor or like, and maybe that conversation alludes talking to a family member. Why should one want to become an organ donor?
I think many people will come to this for different reasons. But if you think about it, everyone on this earth at some point is going to pass on. They're going to die. And the question becomes, what do you want your legacy to be? If you're able to help someone in need, would you do that? If you're no longer in need of your organs and you've passed on, what would be the value of helping your fellow person in need? And as you mentioned, there's over 100,000 people waiting for an organ right now. In Illinois itself, there's over 7,000 people or 4,000 people in Illinois. In Northwest Indiana, the area I think where your listeners are, there are currently about 1,000 people in Northwest Indiana waiting on an organ donor, organ donation. And in 2020, there were 15 organ donors from that area. There's 9 hospitals and 7 long-term care facilities where you are. There were 15 organ donors in all of 2020, and there's 1,000 people in that area. So the need is great. And I think sometimes if people know what the need is, they would be more willing to be an organ donor should that occur. There's also living donation. There's many people that are sitting there waiting for a kidney, which, by the way, is the most predominant organ that people are waiting for on that under 8,000. And a kidney transplant could save their life. So that's really one of the reasons. It's purely altruistic. It really provides a better end to your life. It leaves a lasting legacy, and it is truly life-saving. It is truly a second chance at life for those 108,000 people waiting.
That's great. That's great. Now, a lot of people always wonder, they talk about the issue of race and ethnicity. Is there, quote unquote, a need for more African Americans or Latinos to become organ donors?
Yeah, there is. And I would say that there's a need for more organ donors in general. I will tell you that there is a disparity in terms of the number of people waiting on the wait list for kidneys. About 60% of those are African American people of colors. And of those who donate, it's probably in the 30 to 35% range. Even though it is certainly able to have organ donation transfer across race. So a white person could donate to a black person and a black person could donate to a white person. It's just a matter of matching the DNA areas. We call them HLA loci. It's not race-based. But there is a better match if that can be done. So in general, the need is great, and we really want to encourage everyone to donate. But there is a bit of a disparity between communities of color and non-communities of color.
In a past story that I've done, a report that I did a few years ago about organ donations, a doctor who specializes in organ transplants once told me, and I thought it was a beautiful quote in that, whether you're black or white or Latino or Chinese, under the skin, we are all the same. And it sounds like a great message, but a science base, we are all the same.
It is so true. And I will tell you, before I became CEO of Gift of Hope, I was a trauma surgeon for 36 years. And what would happen is, you typically get a call and there's a stab wound or a gunshot wound or a horrible car crash or motorcycle crash. And you run in there, and first of all, your team that you're working with is from all walks of life and all colors. And then you're all after one common goal, is trying to save a life. You're not trying to save a black person or a white person or a CEO or a homeless person. You're trying to save a life. And so when you get up to the operating room and you prep the patient and put the gowns on and the covers, you open them up, and as you're working inside, there is absolutely no difference. And so to me, it's the great equalizer. Trauma does not discriminate against age, race, or social status. Neither does organ failure. You know, there are CEOs that are on the dialysis waiting list, as well as homeless people. So it is a great equalizer. So I absolutely agree with the surgeon's quote that you mentioned.
If people want to find out more about organ transplant, especially during this month, what would you suggest?
The first thing I would say is go directly to the Gifts of Hope website. It's giftsofhope.org. And there's lots of stories of donor families and recipient families. There's lots of frequently asked questions. There's data there. There's links to different stories. So that would be the number one. I would tell them to listen to your show as well. Thank you very much for having me on for this. But during this National Donate Life Month, we have several events, virtual events. They're mostly virtual because of the ongoing COVID-19 restrictions. But there's several campaigns on Facebook and social media. We have a Creating a Lasting Legacy multimedia campaign that features three donor stories. Nikki Smith and Jamie Acevedo-Lube and Andrew Morton. That's our current campaign that's going throughout our service area. We also have shared lots of these materials on our website. And again, that's giftofhope.org. I would encourage people to go to that. And then a lot of our community partners, hospitals and other areas, are having online registration drives throughout the month. So lots of different places to go, but I would start with giftofhope.org.
Dr. Harry Wilkins is president and CEO of Gift of Hope. Dr. Wilkins, thank you so much for joining us here today on Off Mic.
Well, thank you for having us.
And we'll be back with more Off Mic. Welcome to Off Mic on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Michael Plante. Being so close to Chicago, Northwest Indiana can take advantage of world-class museums, theaters, sporting events, and so much more. And that includes some of the nation's best pediatric hospitals. But if you're a parent of limited means and your child needs treatment for cancer or other illnesses, you're probably spending a lot of time in the car driving to Riley's Children's Hospital in Indianapolis. Why? Because many low-income Hoosier kids are turned away from out-of-state hospitals because Indiana will not pay them the same Medicaid rate as in-state hospitals. That forces them to Indianapolis.
Since April of 2014, the Dick Foundation has purchased $24,075 in gas cards for families to travel here from what you all know is the region. Since 2015, we began to offer, at request, car repairs. We have spent $3,807 on car repairs, tires, things to get people down here safely.
That's Donna Kreiner, head of Northwest Indiana Cancer Kids, an organization that tries to help low-income parents get the care their children needs. She spoke at a recent hearing before the House Ways and Means Committee at the Indiana State House.
On more than one occasion, some of our families who were waiting for a ride from Indiana Medicaid, that ride canceled sometimes as early as 10 or as late as 10 minutes before they were supposed to show up to drive them to Indianapolis, resulting in missed cancer treatment for a child.
Here is Northwest Indiana parent Jacina Maldonado at that same hearing.
I had to move from Texas back to Indiana for the help of my family, especially driving 2.5 hours for treatment. We all know being in a car with a toddler for that long is not the easiest to deal with. On top of terrible tubes, and not to mention the steroid rage, the nausea, and just frustration from being in a car seat. The expenses added up quickly, gas, vehicle maintenance, babysitters, and food weekly, on top of not being able to work because I'm constantly with my sick son. I would have to drive to Indianapolis weekly all by myself with a newborn and a toddler who just received chemo. Imagine having to pull over because your sons couldn't stop throwing up from chemo and your newborn screaming in the back. You're crying because those 2.5 hours straight shot drive would make you think of everything wrong in your life or how it's a normal day and your son gets a fever and you have to drive to a local hospital just to wait hours to get an ambulance to go to Riley's.
Even the heads of Chicago's leading hospitals have voiced support for Indiana lawmakers to make a change to the law to help region families. Here is John Cunningham of the University of Chicago.
I'm the chair of the Department of Pediatrics at the University of Chicago. We are the largest provider of Medicaid for in the region, both in Illinois and Northwest Indiana. As some of you know from visiting our institution, we're a 165-bed hospital, which provides comprehensive care for children on the south side of Chicago and in Northwest Indiana. Indeed, we're the closest dedicated children's hospital for children in Indiana, the state line being approximately 8 miles from our front door. Do you want a child to come 150 miles for care or to come from the equivalent of Lebanon, Indiana, to Riley Children's?
And Dr. Matthew Davis of Lurie's Children's Hospital in Chicago.
Like many of you, I'm also a parent. And as parents, our job is to protect, nurture, and secure the healthiest future we can for our kids. I'm here today to say and ask for your support for House Bill 1305, which will allow out-of-state children's hospitals, as you've been hearing, to be reimbursed on par with in-state children's hospitals. In short, this bill will help Indiana parents access high-quality health care for their children closer to home than they do today. The fundamental challenge that a child deserves access to high-quality hospital care designed specifically for children as quickly and as appropriately as possible.
Indiana State Representative Hal Slager has introduced Bill 1305 that would allow Indiana to pay out-of-state children's hospitals the same Medicaid rate as those in Indiana. The bill is getting near to passage after years of fails. Representative Slager joined me by phone yesterday to give me an update on the bill. Tell me a little bit about the bill. I know it's been a long effort. I know that it's been years where other bills sort of to try to take a similar approach have failed. What would this bill do for parents primarily who live in Northwest Indiana?
Well, it provides a higher level of reimbursements to out-of-state children's hospitals only that are contiguous to the state of Indiana that are also registered with Indiana Medicaid. And the purpose of that is so that we can encourage out-of-state hospitals, whether it's in the Chicago market, Louisville, or Cincinnati, to take on those that are just across the border that they might normally not want to take on because they're being paid from Indiana Medicaid and the out-of-state Medicaid rate is far from what they would get from in-state patients.
You know, Representative, I know there's been past efforts to try to change this. What has been the reluctancy of the Indiana legislature to make this change?
I wouldn't call it reluctance. I think the fundamental problem is the case, whether it's at the state level or the federal level. There are very few legislators that have any kind of understanding as it relates to Medicaid. And it's like they're kind of proprietary in that information. It takes a while to learn even what the questions are. And then understanding the funding mechanisms, because it gets very complicated.
So basically it was just trying to educate the lawmakers on the complexity of the issue and the problems. And you're right, it takes somebody who actually lives near the Chicagoland area to actually explain that. I'm sure there are issues of those living close to Cincinnati or Louisville, but it's probably even more some in Northwest Indiana just because of the population size and other issues.
I think the situation, I know the situation exists in those other markets, but I think it might be more dramatic only because Illinois Medicaid, I believe, is more generous with their reimbursement, their Medicaid reimbursements to their hospitals than the other states are. And so it created a much greater disparity.
All right, Representative Slager, thank you so much for speaking with me. I really appreciate it.
All right, thank you.
And that was Representative Hal Slager of Schererville. A final vote of Representative Slager's bill is scheduled for next week. And that is all the time we have for this episode. You can hear this episode again as a podcast by going to lakeshorepublicradio.org. For me, Michael Fuente, and all of us here at Lakeshore Public Radio and Off Mic, have a great weekend.